Welcome to the Certainty Roundtable podcast, designed for those advisory teams preparing for the fast emerging new era of financial advice in Australia. Hosted by Jim Stackpool, founder of Certainty Advice Group, with over 30 years experience advising advisory firms, the Certainty Roundtable podcast brings together the growing group of Certainty Advice firms as they share their insights, experiences, as they attract, attain, price and manage their valuable advice clients and advisory teams. Now, here is your host, Jim Stackpool.
G'day, Jim Stackpool here with another in our roundtable series where we're talking about benchmarking. I love benchmarking. We've been loving benchmarking since the late 90s. And even prior to that, the firm I worked in before I set this business up back in 92 was really into benchmarking up the University of New England. Benchmarking's got a lot of history to it, but it's got a lot of strengths and weaknesses as well. Ensuring who you're comparing to and how relevant is where you are in your cycle compared to some of the firms in the database. But key to it is, as well as there is one key to it, and you'll check it out in this clip. The other thing to bear in mind too is that we are setting up a new benchmarking service from next financial year, and so we'll tell you a bit more about that at the end of this clip too. Check it out. I have to admit right up front that I've got a sort of love-hate relationship with benchmarking. Back in 1997 to 2007, benchmarking was probably the core of everything we did. And we had about, I think, 70% of our revenue was coming in from benchmarking. It grew to be quite a big thing. And this whole, how do we know how we're going? And we had contracts with lots of different organizations. But ultimately, its success was also its greatest failure. And so we are reigniting our benchmarking coming in the coming year. With you all, with learning from that, and just I think now we've got a better chance of actually achieving what we didn't achieve before. And so, as I say, we had bench online calculators available. It was spread, had 1600 participating firms. We had a base of firms giving us data from the UK. We're taking trips over to the UK, implementing the same process. We had all the majors sponsoring it, and that was our biggest problem because we had poor partner alignment, really, and therefore we had. The more data we got, the worse the data looked like in terms of standard deviations, and it became to be quite clear that BDMs were in fact completing the data on the part of participants. And so as we slowly, and also the bigger issue is that all the major institutions were supporting it primarily because they wanted to prove that their platform was more efficient than someone else's platform, and when the results didn't actually reflect that in profitability, we got dropped pretty quickly. Anyway, for a whole host of reasons, but we are introducing benchmarks, this whole conversation about how well we're going. Because I think this whole essence of how do we know as we become more of a consistent methodology approach to running our businesses, we have to have some sort of relativity. And that's all benchmarks are. Not to be used as a weapon of divisiveness, but a weapon of a benefit. Answering this question, what is your favourite business benchmarking number now and why? Mandy, what's your favourite?
It's revenue, and then I look at net profit. I work out what my percentage of net profit is, because you could have a very high number in terms of your revenue, but you could have an equally high number in terms of the cost of running your business.
Yep, spot on. Yeah, so and revenue doesn't grow, firm's profit does. Yep,
yeah, so I look at that percentage. That's how I sort of work it out.
And are you differentiating, Jordan, between prospecting appointments and client appointments or just appointments?
So we use three different types of appointments, so each one of them we track. We then distinguish between not recurring clients, but repeat clients and brand new prospects.
Good. Yeah. And I think for startup phases, managing activity like number of prospecting or alliances appointments or research appointments or client appointments, really, really core number.
Yeah. Revenue would be the main still because we're not in that full profitability stage, but I prefer profit per client. Simple profit divided by number of clients is trend, following that as a trend.
So I want to talk about four different types of benchmarking types now. I want to talk about fee benchmarks, dollar benchmarks. I want to talk about growth benchmarks. I want to talk about profitability benchmarks. And my favorite, I want to talk about productivity. And I also want to touch on, if we get some time, I want to touch on trend benchmarks and valuation benchmarks. And so here, for instance, is the first cut of some, what I call some really core fee benchmarks, uplift per active clients, fee tension per new clients, fee tensions for existing clients. What is, I think, standard and best practice. Breakthrough fees per advisor per annum. That is breakthrough client fees per advisor per annum. Median fee growth, so not the average, but the median fee growth per advisor year on year. Annual revenue trends. total revenue percentage increases. New revenue as percentage of total revenue. Some really key core numbers there.
Do you actually get the reporting around annual revenue trends actually showing that businesses are lifting up by 20% year on year?
Yeah, well, I think, again, it's how sustainable is that's a great question, but yeah, definitely, or even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, look, in some years you'd say, oh, I'm not going to be best practice for a whole host of reasons we're consolidating. But it's in terms of that trend. And the danger is, and some firms blitz 20% easily, but consistently building it without stripping the teeth off the cogs of the machinery that's running the firm. Yeah, it's going too hard too early on, particularly trying to find team members to do it. It's hard.
And Jim, a breakthrough is defined in your definition as a new client that you've signed that is better than your top five average. Is that correct?
Per advisor, James. So I might have someone just starting out, and a breakthrough for them might not be a breakthrough for you.
Yes.
So that's a breakthrough fee per annum per advisor. Again, so the two things here. One is the ratio. Is that maybe that bit beneficial? And more ratio analysis isn't better than less. It's just that might be a good ratio we need to track. And the number, is that relative to what you perform? And even is that something I might want to get a trend for? And that's what really we're trying to get some of the debate going here in some of these numbers. So that's what I think is, I think, and there's lots of other fee-based ratios, but in the data and the approach we're about to start from next financial year for you, we're looking at these sort of ratios we think are going to be the area we're going to be focusing upon with some of the stuff we're going to start to collect. So that's that ratio. Let's go back and now let's start looking at so these are some of the growth rates. This is a bit more new business growth, whatever it might be. So new productive clients per annum. And a productive client isn't just any client. A productive client is a good client as compared to another one of the not so good clients. So that in that definition, it's not about activity, it's about productivity. And going back to your comment before, Jordan, you know, if you're in startup phase, any client's a good client, so any client's productive. But when you get past startup phase, it's this, what's the growth of productive clients? And these might be, for those much more familiar with our segmentation model, these might be more management, manager or principal type clients as compared to transactional type clients. And so we see the standard is about 10% of, we'd see new productive clients per annum, about 10% of actives per advisor. Not too sure what best practice is. I don't think we've got enough data on that to analyze it. Alliance introduced, and so we are big here on these growth numbers on what's the quality and introduction of productive clients from alliances or introduction of productive new clients from referrals. 60% of introductions there for referrals, 40% best practice, 20% from alliances, 50% of introductions from alliances for best practice. So you see, we think best practice is I'm getting a lot more quality introductions coming in from alliances. And we think long term, it's your alliances that give you the productive introductions long term. But having said that, and some firms might get it who are in more complex work, I get a lot more work from my alliances. Some firms not so complex work, I probably get a lot more introductions from my client base. And that's not better, it's just different. But it's quite clear that that's the sort of number we'd expect that if I've got my new business hat on and I've got my methodological approach to ensuring I'm continually working those alliances referrals, these are sort of best practice numbers we'd be expecting.
And Jim, your definition of productive?
Well, again, as I said, it's more in the sweet spot of the firm as compared to the activity phase of the firm. You know, in terms of it's not adding more clients below the median fee, probably. It's probably giving more clients that meet the median or above the median fee. Okay, let's keep going on terms of these benchmarks. So productivities, and I love these numbers. I love productivity stuff. My favorite, face time. You know, what is that time that advisors are generally spending in front of networks, alliances, clients, doing marketing, doing prospecting, working their centers of influence. What's the face time? For available hours, what's that face time per week? Generally, still the numbers are less than 30% of people's week is actually doing the stuff. And again, in smaller firms, it's much harder to achieve, particularly from the admin phase, but trying to get up to that 60%, that's a really high bar to get toward a 60% face time. And so again, now it's face time is changing. Obviously, we're doing more stuff with Zoom. We can engage a client. So that's including that amount of time per week, per availability of that face time. Active clients per FTE, again, that's too hard to track and give some sort of benchmark on that, but total revenue per FTE, I love this number. And I think this is an FTE, full-time equivalent. Increasingly, the question, well, do I include my offshore staff? Are they part of that FTE number? And that's a really sort of questionable one. Generally, I'm saying no at this stage. It's generally probably more a cost, but I think that's probably going to shift. Let's see what sort of the numbers are. We start doing our own benchmarking. Total revenue per senior and median age. So a median client age, just want to see an improving trend. They're what we think are our core productivity numbers.
What's the median client age, Jim?
Well, just all ages of all clients, and who's the client in the middle?
And what would be an improving trend? Would that be getting younger or would it be getting older?
You'd make, if you're moving to a niche, it's probably up here. I'd want to see it shift. But I don't think it's, you know, the old days it was 62. And we're saying, well, it depends. What's the improving shift for where your firm's going? Other one I want to present now is the profitability numbers. Again, as those have done some benchmarking with us, we know we don't compare owner's salaries, owner remuneration. So everything is boss before owner's salaries and packaging. And so the net profit number we're generally still seeing is about this 25%. Best practice we think is 40%. Trying to hit that 40% before an owner's notional. Net profit per FTE depends again, number of people we've got. In terms of best practice and standard, net profit per active client, again, it depends upon your number of active clients you've got. Non-salary costs per FTE, we think this is a crucial number in terms of, and this is probably where the offshore staffing thing starts to occur. If we are recurring offshore teams as a non-direct salary internally, then is this number still going to keep as low as it is for best practice? Not sure. But we have seen, again, this data has been fairly consistent ever since we've been doing. So this is all non-salary costs. What's the cost of running a business, the license? What's the cost of the marketing, the web, the rent, the IT? What's the cost of offshore per person employed, full-time equivalent? All the core, what we think is profit is. So this is just basic cost management as you're running your business. The important aspect of all this stuff too is the relativities. And so, it is the discussion about benchmarks. Discussion about benchmarks has to have some sort of, and we all know wobble theory and how that goes from as we set up and we grow, we start to grow again, we hit the admin stage, we have to go a dip, we grow again, we hit the management stage, we grow again, have a dip, grow again into management stage, M&A stage, distribution stage, etc. And so, interestingly, we would say the tracking then of, for instance, your returns, we generally find that this number. So if you look at, you might have a $375,000 number here per senior advisor. And so one activity number, $375,000 per senior, might be good if I'm in admin phase. But I would be saying by the time I again go through the management phase and I'm getting up into the dependency phase, I want to be making sure that my return per senior is getting closer to, say, this $750,000 per senior advisor. And so what I'm getting at is the trend changes, just like the trend changes for something like return per person. So return per person, if I was a solo operator by myself, I might have a return per person with part-time staff here of, say, you know, close to $200,000. If I managed to get with part-time staff a return per person for FTE, but then maintaining that while I get to $750,000, that actually might even go down to $175,000. Because I'm loading up with people to make sure I can keep the productivity in my senior. And so it's sometimes the balance of one trend whilst you're watching another is not linear. One might be going one way and another one might be going slightly another. And for instance, something like FaceTime. I can right up here in the early times of business, when I'm starting to get going and I'm doing whatever I can to generate business, get out there, I might have a high 40% FaceTime right down here when I'm out there and doing whatever I need to do to grow my business. When I smack into the admin phase, my FaceTime simply now trying to catch up with all the stuff that needs to be done and following up on all the forms and making sure all the underwriting's done and doing all the, our FaceTime can drop. But one of the objectives then, once we get through, we should be again trying to get FaceTime up to 30%, and then we focus on better priorities. We should be probably getting up towards about 40%. And if I'm not getting FaceTimes up to close to this 60% number, as I start to go into this M&A phase, then I'm simply going to be replicating a model that's only got my key people out there 40% of their time. And so the trend over time changes. So I think the internal analysis, I keep coming back to it, as long as you're consistent with a set of numbers, check them against what we can provide you with some benchmarking. But the internal analysis is really, really crucial. There's one more thing I just wanted to share with you on this, because I think there's another number which is becoming even more important for those that are growing, and we are all to a certain extent, growing new businesses and more profitable businesses. And that's this concept of what I call super profit. So I think increasingly, in terms of valuation, whilst we are going through a really interesting phase of the industry, and valuations are still between this nexus of recurring revenue and EBITDA, I think a new valuation model is going to eventually occur, which I'm calling based upon this concept of super profits. And so super profit, if for instance I've got a net profit, just for the sake of the maths, of $300,000, and that's before owner's notional. So let's say the owner is taking out, owner's package takes out $200,000. And let's say the owner has also capitalized, the owner's put some money in to get the business going, they bought a base, and they paid, let's say for the sake of it, they've got a base, they bought a base of clients for $200,000. Now they would want some sort of return on that $200,000 over and above the risk-free rate of money. If I put it in the bank, I might get 1% if I'm lucky, but if I've invested in my business, it's non-negotiable, it's tied up in the business, I've taken the risk. And so maybe even up to, we would say, 15% return on that $200,000 every year, which would put out, I want another, on that number then, another $70,000. And so the number left over then is what we call, what I call, super profits. So after taking out the net profit, after taking out the package, and then after taking out a return of any money they may have invested in the business, any capital they put into the business to get the thing going, we then have this figure of super profits, which in this analysis, with this analysis, works out to be, actually that's not 70, that's 30, isn't it? Works out to be 70, I just got my maths wrong. And so therefore, how does super profit relate to valuations? Well, it's pretty simple. Then if you sort of, what is the capitalization rate? So I've got a capitalization rate equals my return, which is super profits. That's the return I get, just like a dividend, over a goodwill factor. So in this case, if we can still see this board, we can, yep. This case we've got, so $70,000 is a super profit. Now, if I was selling this business and the principal's walking with it and going away, I might say, well, my chance of actually, without the principal in this tiny business making this money, I might have a capitalization rate. The risk of this thing is 100%. So I've only got, you could have a 100% risk rate that I could probably lose it all if it was all the clients were attached to the principal. And so I might say that's a really risky purchase with the principal leaving within the first, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months of the, and so I'm not only willing to pay a goodwill factor of $70,000 to earn the $70,000 super profit. That also doesn't buy me that debt, that money that's still sitting in there. And so in terms of trying to figure out, I think the correlation between what is goodwill and super profits, I think this is going to be a valuation driver of the future. Now, there are obviously, well, if I can change the cap rate, if the business owner was staying on, I have a lower cap rate, the systems are really good, the niches are really good, the alliances are really good. You know what? I think the risk of this is down around 20%. So if that's down around 20%, then I'm going to pay $350,000 super profit, a goodwill, to acquire that super profit. And so whilst there's a lot of negotiables, I think more and more as these businesses mature, we're going to be looking at this idea of super profits, I think, as a business benchmark. Anyway, if any of you are getting into the conversations where you're talking about purchasing or valuation or doing valuations, let's just have that. Let's help those valuers get there with this sort of approach. And again, this is that sort of, we were talking about this stuff 20 or 30 years ago at University of New England about the super profit model of valuations, and even when we're working with valuers. So it's going to be an increasingly interesting topic, I think, as the industry gets more and more around stable businesses growing great systems with great leads, really good propositions, really good brands, getting away, I think, from purely just top line EBITDA, or and hopefully definitely getting away from just renewal of ongoing revenue. There you go. What did you think? Internal benchmarking. If we took nothing from this session other than the need to get some consistent, specific and methodical approach to your own internal benchmarking and seeing some sort of improvement, there's lots of different things we could be benchmarking, but based upon the issue that you're facing, the size of firm you are, that might be more relative over a quarter or half year or even over a year to start tracking specific growth for you and getting that trend. Love to provide some external stuff that we can provide as well, but really the strength of benchmarking is your ability and discipline to record stuff internally. We will start developing from next financial year, starting in July, and using our web-based capture to get some information off you to then share it back with you based upon the firms that are using Certainty Advice as their principal advisory model. But Any other questions out of this? Well, hopefully you got a copy of the slides where you can see some of the benchmarks that we have been using. And we think those are the core ones. Well, we'd definitely be building our benchmark models based upon those. As always, love to get your feedback on this stuff. Raises lots of questions, benchmarking, because all of the firms are at different levels. Helping you set up your own internal benchmarking. Love to be in contact if there's anything we can do to assist. Hope this has been beneficial for you. Take care. Jim Stackpole signing out.
Thank you for listening to the Certainty Roundtable podcast with Jim Stackpole. To access the material from today's show or to join in the conversation, head to www.certaintyadvicegroup.com. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions, and opinions. Working together, we hope to achieve a lot more for more Australians. CertaintyAdviceGroup.com.